Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party, the only podcast to take you through the entire back catalogue of A24 films, two films every fortnight, alongside interviews with some of the cast and crew involved in making them. On today's show, we might be currently around 20 films away from the end of the project, but we've reached the climax. Well, Gaspar knows climax, to be fair, and the Irish horror, The Hole in the Ground. I'm your co-host, Dallas King, currently podcasting in his brand new 40th birthday present of an A24 grey crew neck jumper, and with me as always is Lee Hutchison. How are you? Are you wearing your midsummer tea to join me in this A24 fest?
It's 4:15 in the afternoon and I'm wearing my pyjama trousers and a scruffy t-shirt. So yeah, it's safe to say I feel more like I'm a hole in the ground than climaxing with my life right now.
I see. Clearly you had no Zoom or Microsoft Team video call meetings today then.
Oh, I've got one later on today, so there'll be a costume change for that.
Excellent. Cool. Well, you know, as Lee have maybe briefly alluded to there, we're currently still on lockdown, and that includes all cinemas in the UK and the US and pretty much everywhere else in the world. So there is very little A24 or A24 project updates for you. But one benefit of the lockdown is that filmmakers aren't able to film, and therefore they have slightly more time on their hands. And that time is spent responding to DMs that Lee has been sliding into over the last week. So Lee, I think you've got some exciting news to share with listeners, don't you?
Yeah, we've got one of our sort of white whales of the podcast. We have got a 70-minute long interview, God bless the lockdown, with the writer-director of A Ghost Story and The Green Knight, David Lowry. So I interviewed him yesterday and we will be dropping that one on May the 4th. So yeah,
Star Wars Day.
Yeah, there is a little bit of chat about Revenge of the Sith and the Star Wars prequels in amongst all the chat. So yeah, it was a real exciting one. It kind of came around through someone we had previously interviewed who kind of put us together, so it was an absolute treat to talk with him yesterday. I don't know about you, there's good days and bad days in sort of lockdown, and yesterday evening was a really kind of special one to be able to chat with David about one of my kind of all-time favorite A24 films.
Did you eat any pie while interviewing him?
No, I didn't. But we did talk about the pie, so that's something to look forward to as well.
Absolutely, I can't wait to hear that in a couple of weeks when it goes live. But first up today, it's going to be 2018's Climax, which was written and directed by Gaspar Noe, the director behind such infamous films as Enter the Void and Irreversible. French dancers gather in a remote empty school building to rehearse on a wintry night. The all-night celebration morphs into a hallucinatory nightmare when they learn that their sangria has been laced with LSD. So, Lee, when was the first time that you sort of heard of and indeed saw Climax, and what kind of impression did it leave on you?
Yeah, this is certainly an interesting kind of question to pose, because I think, I'm sure we'll get into this when we kind of really start to break down the film, is I loved the trailer for this film when it kind of came out, and I immediately had this on the top of my must-see list. I just thought it was so hypnotic. I love the use of music, the imagery. It just looked like an absolutely knockout trailer. So I had my ticket, I went along to see it, and I'm sure we'll come into it later, our thoughts on when we watched it, but the first time I caught it, while I did feel it went on a little bit, I thought it was a really great experience within the cinema. You know, I remembered it being like a really sunny day. I went with former guest on this podcast, Laura. We went along to see it. You know, there was barely anyone in the cinema on this like hottest day of the year, but I was kind of transfixed by the film. I was really impressed by the cinematography, the choreography. It's something we've not been able to talk about in this project so far. I was stressed, I was anxious. I really enjoyed the experience the first time around. I thought it was a really good advert for going along to see films in the cinema. And yeah, I thought it lived up to this fantastic trailer that was released.
Yeah, I saw this film for the first time last week. Never got around to seeing it in the cinema. I was aware of it. You know, Gaspar Noe is someone who is very sort of Marmite. I mean, his films are, I think you sort of described it as, you know, the cinematic experience. His films are definitely an experience when you watch them. You're going to have a reaction, whether it's emotional or indeed probably physical, to his films. I mean, Irreversible is one of the most infamous of all time, with some incredibly sort of shocking moments, but it's a film you're never going to forget, and I don't think this one is definitely going to stay in the memory for a long time, whether that's for good or bad, I guess we can talk about. But yeah, it was certainly an experience watching this. I sadly had to catch it on Netflix. It had been on my Netflix list for a long time, just with being on the project, and eventually got around to seeing that. And indeed, Hole in the Ground are both available on Netflix, certainly in the UK at the moment, if you're wanting to watch along with us. You know, you can pause the podcast, go watch both of them, and then come back and then find out what we've got to think. So when did you revisit this one?
I revisited it yesterday while in lockdown. I've been watching a lot of films, as I imagine most people that kind of listen to this podcast are while in lockdown. And I was kind of curious to revisit again. I'd sort of watched maybe the first 10 minutes kind of numerous times really over the past 18 months or so, because it was a really impressive opening, and it's available on YouTube to watch that bit. So yeah, I kind of enjoyed being able to kind of catch that bit. But ultimately, I found the film a bit of a slog to get through on a repeat viewing. Ultimately, some films work really well in the cinema when you're sort of there, transfixed, and it's a good first-time experience, and it's not necessarily meant to be sort of a repeat viewing. It just didn't sort of hold me on the second time. I was kind of watching it, and my girlfriend came in at one point and she sat down, and it was during the scene where it's the overhead shot of the sort of a non-stop dance sequence. I was like, oh yeah, I think this dance choreography is pretty impressive. She's like, it's not that impressive. And the scene seemed to go on forever and ever, and I just felt like it was such a bad time for her to come in, because there was nothing going to get her to sit down and watch more of this film when it was just like minute after minute of just people sort of dancing around, looking down on people's heads. It didn't certainly grip her, and it just struggled to kind of keep my attention on a repeat viewing. And, you know, there's something to be said perhaps about that, but sometimes, as I say, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing if the film banged on one screening at one time and it just struggles to hold you the second time. Not all films need to be enjoyable and hold up on repeat viewings. I thought it was a good cinema experience, just less so at home, maybe because I was, you know, I don't know. I think it was something good to be experienced in the cinema. I think it struggled to kind of hold the attention, keep the tension up back home.
Yeah, no, I think there's something to be said for films which make an immediate impact on first viewing, but then there's maybe something about them that, yeah, whether it's designed to be seen on a big screen and it loses something when it reduces it down to a small screen, or sometimes there's a film which is maybe just meant to be viewed once and, you know, never again. I'm thinking of Requiem for a Dream, for example. That is a film which is very, very, very intense and an incredible piece of filmmaking, but it's one of those films I see a lot of people saying it's the best film which I would never want to watch again, just because it is so intense and really sort of dark and miserable. So, you know, there's probably elements of that with this. You know, I actually came to Climax actually having seen, unfortunately, it's one of those things where you see a film out of context. I'm thinking of, this is like from the late 80s, I saw the film Repossessed, starring Leslie Nielsen. It was like a Naked Gun style spoof of The Exorcist. And I saw that several times before I then went to see The Exorcist. So The Exorcist was never going to be as powerful and shocking as it was, because I had that in the back of my mind. I hinted at the last episode that I'd seen the dance sequence soundtrack with a different song on top of it, and I couldn't remember for the life of me during that point what it was, but I then remembered, basically guaranteed, as soon as the podcast finished, I remember what it was, and it was the Jellicle song, the Jellicle Ball song from Cats, and it totally works. And I imagine this is like a similar A24 project film, Ex Machina, with the dance sequence with Oscar Isaac and that you could put any song on top of it and it still works. And, you know, that's how I came to this film, and that initial sort of dance sequence, the choreography, I really liked the choreography of it. I thought it was really well put together, a fantastic sort of sequence. It really sort of, the use of music in this film is exceptional. I think there's, you know, some Daft Punk in there, there's some Gary Newman, there's even like Rolling Stones and stuff, songs that you wouldn't normally expect. I was expecting it certainly from the initial soundtrack to be potentially like very sort of French sort of electro sort of stuff that was all Daft Punk, but it uses a mashup of different styles, so that was great. And you know, that song dance sequence all done in one continuous take, that one lasts about sort of 10 minutes, and I think one of the reasons is when you start off that strongly, how are you going to be able to maintain that kind of momentum going forward? Certainly in the second half of the film, it does sort of pick up again with, I think, around about a 42-minute one-take, one-track sequence. But the bit in the middle is where this film kind of lost me, and I think there's several reasons for that. Apparently, this film was shot, it was written, shot, and edited in 4 months in order to meet its deadline for Cannes. And it started off with a 5-page script, and apparently all the dialogue was essentially improvised. Would you call her a lead in this? I'm not sure, but Sofia Boutella, who has starred in films like The Mummy, she is the only professional actor. Apparently everyone else came from a dancing background, so they weren't professional actors. So, you know, sort of piecing together and allowing them to come up with the story, you know, with just using very key sort of points and markers that they had to hit. Sometimes that could potentially lead to an incredible piece of filmmaking. For me, I think it was either the characters or some of the plot lines in it just didn't really have enough to hold my attention beyond the sort of amazing sort of, I think we talked about this with 1917, where it became a case of, I was more concerned with looking about how the filmmaking and where the camera moved as opposed to what was going on in the scene. And I think this was a case of that, when you start to notice the filmmaking rather than the story, you know, that wasn't strong enough to hold my attention. I mean, what did you make of the sort of long takes and the almost improvised style of filmmaking from Gaspar Noé on this?
I think it worked well for this, and I suppose the difference between something like this and 1917 is they were hanging their hat on, you've never seen anything quite like 1917, it's all one take, and it was all part of the kind of the gimmick, really. I just thought it was a, you know, it's kind of a standard way now to tell kind of stories, is this one take. And I thought it was very well put together, especially kind of, there was plenty to kind of keep you stimulated in terms of what you were seeing kind of visually on screen. And I enjoyed sort of this stroll around this sort of kind of party complex, really, as everything was kind of falling apart. I just ultimately felt on the repeat view in that the film worked well the first time. And the second time I was like, I just kind of would have been happy with that first sort of 10-minute dance sequence and just watching the trailer, because the trailer is essentially the spirit and feeling of the film all condensed into sort of like a 2-minute, 3-minute kind of little montage, and that works really well. And you come away thinking, really good trailer, that would be a good little mini short film. But it was a really kind of long, I don't know what the ultimate time was, 96 minutes, which does feel kind of excessive for something that is kind of very thin on the ground in terms of plot and kind of character.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, to be fair to this, you know, in respect to 1917, this did certainly look to me like the action was all caught in one single take. There were no sneaky edits or anything like that. So, you know, that aspect completely worked for me. I know that, sort of checking on IMDb for the trivia, of course, as we always do for these films. Gaspar Noé was apparently saying that the first half was meant to be like a roller coaster, and then the second half like a ghost house. So, I mean, the roller coaster, I guess, is sort of going along with the dance sequence, where it's very sort of energetic and you don't really know what's happening. And then the ghost house, where everything starts to fall apart. And I mean, you had this apparent sort of mystery. I mean, I actually haven't seen the trailer for the film, so it's the first thing I'm going to do when we finish recording this podcast, is actually watch the trailer to find out how good it is. And because I normally don't like to watch anything about these films in advance now, I'm sort of coming in with a fresh pair of eyes if I haven't seen it before. But, you know, I'm certainly going to do that. And I think, I mean, in terms of this mystery aspect, because, you know, there's this whole thing about who actually spiked the punch. I mean, I think it's basically finally resolved in about like the last sort of 10 seconds of the film. But I mean, did you want to maybe see a bit more of that, about who did it, or ultimately did it not really matter?
It didn't matter too much, really, but I think it would have made for a better movie, to be honest. I think, like, if you had something kind of, you know, instead of kind of people just constantly sort of walking around and walking in on things, like, if you had sort of like a mystery trying to unfold while you're sort of heavily spiked, you know, with all the sort of stimulus of noise and terror that's kind of going on, I think it could have made for a really interesting film. Like, how do you get to the bottom of that mystery in sort of the worst possible circumstances and with your sort of brain kind of tied behind your back in a way?
Yeah, no, I think there could have been a way to basically have the answer sort of hidden in plain sight. Maybe whether it was like you actually did see it in the background, but you weren't really aware of it first, and then through flashbacks, or maybe someone had, with the use of like someone had a video camera or something, and then you basically find out at the end that was what it was, something like that, you know? Because I mean, there's an Italian horror film called Deep Red and Profondo Rosso, to give its Italian title, and in that, and also Dario Argento's other film, Bird of the Crystal Plumage, the killer is actually revealed in the film quite near the beginning, but you don't actually realise you see it, and then it's referred to in a flashback, and then you go, wow, okay, why didn't I notice that? And then you go, actually, was that actually there? But then if you actually rewind the film, it is actually there from the beginning. It's just, you know, really told filmmaking that it presents something, but it diverts you. It's just, you know, it's a trick of the light or whatever, and it takes you away from seeing what you should have been seeing by distracting. And I think that's a really sort of clever way of doing it. I think something like that here could have maybe added to that, because, I mean, with, you know, no disrespect to the art of dancing, whatever, this film certainly feels like very much style over substance, that there isn't really much there. I mean, if you boil it down to the fact that Gaspar Noé had a 5-page script, there really wasn't there much to begin with, and the fact that they've managed to get, you know, a film out of it is impressive. And, you know, I think this is definitely a film which is worth seeing. I don't want to be sound too critical, you know, I didn't like it for various aspects of, certainly some of the characters were not very pleasant, and there wasn't really any one particular person to sort of latch on to as a lead to sort of take you through this story. But as a technical exercise, I mean, it's certainly very impressive. I mean, is ultimately that what you feel as well?
Yeah, I think so. It was an advert for the cinema experience, and something I think we're all desperate to get back to. If they probably shoved this film on as the first film back on when it opened, it would probably make monster box office. But yeah, ultimately it was, you know, a good experience when I saw it. You know, one I still respect as sort of a technical achievement on a repeat viewing, but one I can't imagine sort of going for a third watch in the future.
You know, unless, you know, that it was the option of a repeat of Climax or Trolls 2 World Tour on at the cinema when you get back.
Yeah, there's that meme at the moment where there's like two people fighting at AMC or something like that. And I saw it, was like, this is me when it gets to like the Minions film tickets having sold out. So yeah, I think I'm just desperate to get back to the cinema. Anything, I will take anything. Give me The Revenge of the Green Dragons, you know, anything.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, no, I'm the same. I just can't wait to get back. I mean, there's a clip going around at the moment of a screening of Avengers Endgame with people losing their minds when Cap picks up Mjolnir and stuff like that. And it's like, yeah, that's what I miss. I mean, obviously, I don't want my crowds to be as raucous and vocal as that all the time, but it is that, just that shared experience of being there and knowing that people, you're in a group of like-minded people all enjoying the same thing at the same time. Obviously, it's very difficult to do that at the moment. I know some people are doing like tweet-along viewings, or, you know, watching a movie over Zoom or Skype or Microsoft Teams or whatever they're doing. But it's just not the same. And I really look forward to being able to get back to that. Would I watch Climax again on the big screen? No, probably not. If I want to see a really well choreographed dance number followed by 30 odd minutes of people losing their minds and everything going to hell, I'll just watch the Suspiria remake. So that's my view. So yeah, that's a film which is not A24, but very much like A24. So next up is The Hole in the Ground, which was released in late 2018, early 2019, and in the UK, and it is written and directed by Lee Cronin, And the film is about a single mother living in the Irish countryside with her son next to a giant sinkhole. When the boy goes missing one night, she starts to believe the boy who returned is not really her own son. So, Lee, when was the first time you encountered the hole in the ground, and did you fall straight into its spell, or did it leave you cold?
I caught this one at the cinema, and I thought it was fine enough at the cinema, but it contained a lot of tropes I find quite tiresome. And again, with sort of similar to Climax, when I was rewatching it today, I really felt the 90-minute kind of runtime. It's another film where the plot feels very kind of thin on the ground. There's a lot of repetition. In this case, it also has an annoying young child. But this one, I suppose, I kind of wish had been maybe sort of, you know, hit by an electrocution sort of wire and as a hit in Climax. So yeah, this was quite a struggle to kind of get through. On the first watch of the cinema, I thought it was fine enough. You know, it was a movie to watch in the evening kind of thing. I thought the lead performance from the actress Shayna Kralowski as Sarah, I thought she was particularly excellent. But I just really struggled with this young kid and the amount of times he was saying mummy, and just, yeah, it's just a film that takes a long time to get to the hole, the titular hole in the ground.
Yeah, no, mommy, are you all right, mummy? Are you all right, mummy? Any kid who, I mean, there's clearly something wrong with a kid, you know, before, you know, we get into what happens. But any kid that says mummy and whatever, I mean, yeah, that's a shovel to the head kind of kid, I think. I think, I mean, it's a very good performance. And, you know, there's nothing, I don't want to say, it's not down to the actor, whatever. The actor is very, very good. It's just that that character is incredibly annoying. I think there are some excellent child actors that deliver some really intensely annoying, unlikable children out there. I'm thinking of the kid in The Babadook, for one, really memorable one recently. Another Irish production, actually, in Vivarium. That kid is so annoying. And yeah, you could understand why people would want to cause harm to the children. So I don't know if that is a good thing or a bad thing. Do you want to be on the side of the child or the mother who thinks it? I don't know.
Well, I liked it in Vivarium personally, because I thought, yeah, like, that is a purposely really annoying kid, mm-hmm, and like harm comes to that child. whereas like this, it's just like, oh my God, just like, we're stuck with this kid for 90 long minutes. He's at the center of everything. And yeah, it was just painful to watch this little kid. I just wanted him gone.
You wanted to chuck him back into the hole in the ground where he keeps, from whence he came.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think one of the problems I have with this, I mean, I know what you're saying about it being repetitive, is that it's like, oh, you know, that's not my son. You know, she talks to someone and says, that's not my son. Like, of course, it's your son. No one believes her. I mean, there's an apparent backstory about the fact that she left her abusive husband and the father of the child behind. So maybe she's not in the right sort of mental frame of mind, but you know, this has happened to, you know, you've got the crazy old woman standing in the middle of the road, which is a trope from other horror films. You know, this is a debut feature, so I can understand why certain things you sort of lean into them in order to produce a, you know, audience friendly horror film which ticks a lot of the boxes. But yeah, no, for one of the main things I found with this, and I don't know if it was just my TV or whatever, but I find it an incredibly dark film to watch in terms of the lighting. I really struggled to make out what was going on some of the times, whether it's particularly in scenes where she's like looking through underneath the door or through a keyhole or something. It was very difficult to make out some of the action because a lot of it takes place at night. And yeah, I mean, did you find that as well, or was it just me?
Yeah,
I mean,
I tried turning up the
brightness on my computer and my TV and stuff, but yeah, no, it just seemed very, very dully lit. I mean, it was potentially a creative choice, but yeah, no, it just didn't really work for me. I wanted to be able to see what was going on, which is, you know, I think a fair, you know, point to have.
No, I totally agree with you, because I remembered when I saw this in the cinema, I was really struggling, especially in the last bit when they get to the hole in the ground. I was like, what, right, what's going on here and stuff. And you sometimes think, have they got the 3D lens kind of over it or something like that? And it just sort of like was kind of very difficult to watch. And when you're in a darkened room, you can almost feel yourself just slightly drifting off a little bit. But then when I was watching it again this morning, when it got to sort of the same stretch of film, I was like, I cannot see what's bloody going on here. So I think it's safe to say in sort of the two environments that we've kind of learned that the film is just sort of quite badly lit at that point.
Yeah, no, it's a shame because, you know, if I'd been able to see more, I mean, I think it kind of took me out of the film by having it sort of by struggling to do it. You're then sort of, you know, taken out of it, whereas you want to be sort of fully immersed. And it's especially, like you say, when it gets into the final third. And, you know, I'm not going to spoil it for people because, you know, about whether or not the kid is or isn't, I think it's, you know, it's up for debate. But then, you know, maybe it sort of tips its hand one way or the other a bit too early, I think, for me. But, I mean, yeah, it just would have been nicer to have a bit more clarity as to what was going on. And it's not a film which sort of provides much in the way of answers either. I know some people will like things to have sort of all tied up in a nice little bow at the end, but I did like the ending of it, and the ambiguity I thought was quite nice. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of good things about the film, which is, like you say, the performances from the annoying child and then also the lead actress as well. I mean, you get sort of James Cosmo sort of popping up in a little cameo role sort of halfway through the film to kind of further the plot and sort of explain what's been going on and stuff like that. But I mean, do you think more could have been made of the hole in the ground? Could it have become another character in the film?
I think there's certainly, they could have made more of sort of the middle. I think there's something that could be made out of here. I think it probably would have worked quite well as maybe a short, but ultimately my feeling sort of on the repeat viewing is that this is a really good kind of calling card. Well, I know I'm sounding a bit kind of down on the hole in the ground. I thought, as I said, the sort of lead from Sienna Kerr-Skilly and Lee Corrin, I would like to see more of them in the future. With Sienna, for example, Sienna, I'm sure there's a Gaelic way to pronounce it, is that she kind of gave me sort of Jesse Buckley vibes, but with sort of an Irish accent. I thought she was very good.
I'm thinking exactly the same thing. Yeah, she did when she first appeared. I thought, yeah, no, her face is very similar to Jesse Buckley, and yeah, she just certainly makes a striking impression, similar to the way Buckley did. I think the first thing I saw was probably in Taboo, but I think it was Beast that really sort of sold her to me. And then of course she's gone on to do Wild Rose, so hopefully, you know, she gets a similar break as well, I think.
And it's the same with the director. I'd be really interested to see what his next feature is, because while this one sort of falls a bit short, I think he, you know, certainly shows a lot of promise and certainly has a keen eye, and I'd love to see what he would do next. And I hope, you know, I think this film was, you know, a moderate success or something like that. I mean, I had to go to, there was only one cinema in Edinburgh showing at the time and limited kind of screenings, but, you know, there was people there. You know, I think the film is probably proving to be quite popular on Netflix, so I'd be really interested to see what he does and she does next. So we'll kind of see. I think it's certainly a you know, a decent kind of debut feature, so let's see what kind of comes next.
Absolutely, because, you know, from a directorial standpoint, I thought it was impressive. He knows his way around a scene. There was an effective amount of chill, certainly in the middle half where, you know, it's just the two of them in the house. I thought those were at the nighttime, the best scenes. You know, I would probably spend a bit more money on a lighting rig next time, and hopefully that'll improve it. But, I mean, there was, I don't know if it's because we did it for the podcast, but all three of us, but I'd be interested to see what Kim made of this film, because it did remind me a lot of Pet Sematary, with this strange sort of thing in the woods, a new family moving into a house, and then the sort of kid acting weird and stuff like that. So it did feel like a sort of Irish sort of Pet Sematary with a gaping sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer hellmouth in the background. But I think I'm keen to see what Lee Cronin does next, and hopefully it's, whether it's in the world of horror or whether it's something else, I'll be keen to see what comes next for him. But speaking of next, the next episode, where it's the two of us, we are going to be looking at the films Gloria Bell and High Life, aka the 2019 Glasgow Film Festival surprise film, and then the film that everyone expected the Glasgow Film Festival surprise film to be. You were there for that, weren't you, Lee?
Yeah, I was. Everyone expected High Life, and I was pleasantly happy to get Gloria Bell, but I don't think there was anyone in that room that didn't expect it to be High Life.
But yeah, no, they switched in one A24 film for another, so you know, that goes. But Lee, do you want to tease up what people will see next week in terms of our interview schedule?
Yeah, so here's a little kind of brief mini preview of next week's interview. So we're going to be joined by Kevin McMullen, a first-time writer-director of a film called Low Tide, which we're probably a couple months away from discussing on this podcast, where it's a sort of coming-of-age story about sort of a treasure hunt, but a bit darker than you expected. So definitely one to look out for. So here's a brief preview of that interview. At what point does someone like A24 get involved, and what was their pitch to you? Because I imagine you have a few different people kind of going, hey, we'd love to take Low Tide, this is our kind of offer. What was their pitch to you to take Low Tide into their filmography?
I met some folks at A24 based off of the script and that little teaser and lookbook I had put together, and so they were interested from that stage, as were a couple other distribution companies, and really early on in some conversations with some of the producers, we all felt like A24 is just this wonderful distributor with so many great films. And so to me it was a real honor, because whenever I see that logo I kind of perk up, very interested to see what's going on in their catalog, and so I think to kind of have that stamp was a real honor, you know, and it's a pretty cool club to be a part of.
So there we go. So something to keep us going until Gloria Bell and High Life.
Absolutely. But in the meantime, you know, if you enjoy the A24 project and would like to leave us a review on iTunes, please feel free. You know, anywhere from 5 stars to 5 stars is acceptable, of course. But Lee, if people want to chat A24 with you, where can they find you on the old social medias?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at @LeeHutchison_.
And you can find me at a suitable social distancing distance of 2 meters or more on Twitter at DallasKing1138. So until next time, enjoy the A24 films, and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.